Support for Sound Effect comes from WSECU. Local to Washington, WSECU is a credit union founded in public service. Today, WSECU serves more than 260,000 members. More information is available at wsecu.org. WSECU, serving Washington since 1957.
Remember that toilet story?
Well, I guess I should be specific, considering that we've done like 1,000 toilet stories on this show. Okay, this was the one about a local tech guy named Mark who created these basic homemade toilet kits and brought them to people in homeless encampments. He did it for free, on his own time, at his own initiative. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and that story about Mark the Toilet Angel generated a ton of feedback, which was mostly from people wondering how they could go do the same thing. So I've been thinking about what resonated with people about that story, and I think it has a lot to do with the simplicity of a guy who wants to do good, to bring dignity to a difficult living situation, and to recognize what links all of us together, starting with our basic biological needs. Ultimately, this was a story about connection, and that's our theme today on Sound Effect. But it's actually even deeper than that. Connection is our theme at this radio station every single day. Whether it's a news story or a food for thought segment or one of these intimate personal stories that you hear on Sound Effect, we're about connecting with listeners and linking listeners with each other. We're only able to do that because of your support. So today, in the midst of our fall fun drive, we are asking people to visit knkx.org or call 877-NPR-KNKX and support this unique programming. If you give 10 bucks a month as a sustaining member, we can give you this special 8-gig flash drive that's packed with 10 full episodes of Sound Effect, plus the entire run of our acclaimed podcast, Forgotten Prison. So let's keep this thing going strong, and now, let's start the show. First up, we have a story of people making connections where there aren't supposed to be any, where there are actually guard towers and barbed wire specifically to avoid connections between those inside and those outside. And it's a story about baseball. So Seattle NABA is the local branch of the National Adult Baseball Association. When they're not suited up, they're tech workers and bartenders and at least one retiree. The San Quentin A's, in their green and gold uniforms, are all inmates at the San Quentin prison in California. Recently, the Seattle team got the opportunity to head south and play a series against the A's inside the prison. Along for the ride was Steve Albertson, he's director of administration here at KNKX. Two of his brothers play for the Seattle team, and Steve was there to document it.
So the baseball program has been going, I think I was told, for 100 years. So it's been around for a long time. They used to have prison baseball leagues. They would play against army bases nearby. So my understanding is San Quentin is just a very unique prison, and they have a lot of athletic programs. They have baseball, basketball, soccer, flag football, tennis, and there may be some other ones, but they bring in outside teams to play. It's just part of the program for the prisoners. I just assumed it would be very restricted. You know, there'd be a lot of guards around. There wouldn't be a lot of prisoner-outsider interaction. I thought it would be kind of like show up, play baseball, don't talk a lot to the other team, and then leave. And that's really what I was kind of expecting. So you go through a little security. They send you in through one iron gate. And then once you're all in that iron gate, they open the other iron gate, and suddenly you're in the prison. There's palm trees, nice gardening. There's the hospital right there when you come in. But then you go down this ramp, and this long ramp, and you take a left, and suddenly you're in the yard. And it's just this gigantic open space in the middle of the prison. And the thing that struck me immediately is there were no guards. There were hundreds of inmates walking around doing stuff, and there were no guards. It's a beautiful day for baseball. Teams are warming up. They're playing a dual scrimmage.
My name is Liddell Steffi. I'm from Spanaway, Washington. It looks pretty much like a community college or college setting. You have inmates that are walking around with books and class stuff. They have to get to class and stuff like that. And it's up to us to help them get back into society in the future. And that's why I came down.
inmates just started coming up and talking to us. So it was from the get-go a different experience than I expected.
Tamon Halfin.
How long have you been playing baseball with the A's?
I grew up playing baseball, so I've been playing my whole life, but got incarcerated and everything just fell off.
What's it like being on this team?
Man, I love it. It literally takes you away from this environment. It's a beautiful thing. I had no idea that this was a thing until I got here. I never heard of it.
Just very strangely welcoming and very gracious and thankful that we were there to a person. I was really astounded how open and friendly people were. It's not what you'd expect of a pretty serious prison with people who have committed pretty serious crimes.
My name is Michael R. Polito.
I started walking up to people and talking to them, and Michael was wearing, he was part of the San Quentin team. He was wearing a San Quentin jersey.
Well, the story starts, I got arrested at 15 years old. Never really played sports out there on the streets. I was given life without parole.
His position as an equipment manager, very important. Equipment's hard to come by. They track it very carefully because obviously a baseball bat and various other things could be used as weapons in the prison.
Just I felt like I could help them out by doing the equipment, and it's fulfilling for me because I never really had a chance to do it since being locked up so young, you know?
Yeah, it just reminded me, like, I have a 15-year-old son, and, you know, for someone to do something, a crime that would just stop their life at that point, and 28 years later, he's still in jail for it. 15-year-olds make mistakes, and they do, especially in this case, may have done something really terrible, but it's just hard to see somebody whose whole life has just been thrown away like that.
Like, the first time I came to this prison, and I seen these guys in these uniforms, I thought they were people from the streets. So I treated them differently, but when they took off their uniforms and put on the blues, I was like, wow. Now that I'm suited up, I actually make the effort every game to come out here and talk to all these guys, because I used to be out there up along the fence wondering what these guys were doing.
Putting on that uniform, it's like no other. Like, you're not in blue no more. My name is Brandon Terrell. I remember this specific time last year we were playing the Stompers, which is a professional team. It was a Saturday afternoon. I'm like, there's no other place I'd rather be than right here in this moment. Like, I'm gonna get out to my family one day. I'm gonna be, free. However, like, in that moment, like, that experience, what I was feeling that I never had before, and it just was like, I wasn't in prison. On February 23rd, 2012, I was with a friend of mine. We went out, we had a few drinks. I had actually relapsed. I had been sober for 7 months prior to that. For whatever reason, at the dinner table when we were ordering our food and drinks, I decided to order a couple cocktails. And within hours, I was being arrested for murder of my own friend, Ryan Roth. And what happened was an altercation happened, and I ultimately stabbed him. I received 11 years for voluntary manslaughter. And within a week of sitting in that jail cell after, I cleared my mind and realized, that I got a long journey ahead of me and I made a huge mistake and that I can't go back. But I realized there's a purpose out of this, and it's for me to help people down the road get sober, live a sober life, and use my own experience as an example. When these outside teams come in and walk down that hill, the gate shuts behind them. They see the signs, no warning shots. They see the signs, no hostage. I know they had to have some type of feeling, some type of anxiety. Probably they weren't fully comfortable, right? And by the time that first pitch is thrown and we're in that ball game, I want them to understand and get that feeling like they're not in prison, right? Like that we're just men.
So here we are. That's something we gotta do every game. Every practice, run these geese off the field.
The fact that these people come in here, spend the money, take time away from their family, I couldn't say enough to thank them. That's why I go out there and work on the field as much as I do and to the program in general, because I want the inmates in here in the prison to be able to enjoy this facility in the field. However, I feel I owe it to these people that are traveling from distances away to make our field as nice as we can, you know, and have the best experience.
Yeah, what's up, Mark? I got the lineup right here. Come here. Come here. Okay, it's Bird, Brandon, Max.
The baseball field, it looks like any other baseball field, you know, chain link, background dugouts, everything else. They were dragging the field, the infield, when we got there. They were putting in the bases. It looked like any other day you might go to see a baseball game. The fences are a little bit different. The fences, some of them have, you know, razor wire on top of them. The warning track is actually part of a track that all the inmates use to walk around and to run around. So at any given time, if you're an outfielder going for a ball, you have to kind of watch out for people who are back there. There's also some tables where people sit and watch the game. So it's not like a usual ballpark in that sense.
All right, Mark, let's go throw strikes, babe.
The basketball court is down the third baseline.
Oh, that shot. That's a good shot.
And on two occasions, there was a line drive foul ball that went down there. And one guy was sitting there watching the basketball game, and he just got hit on the fly in the head. And it was remarkable because he hardly flinched, and he didn't even turn around to say anything. He didn't say, like, what the heck? Kept watching the basketball game.
My name's David Steele. I am the manager of the team. I also am president of the Seattle NABA.
So what has the baseball been like since you've been here?
Well, they've been playing great baseball. We've been doing our best mediocre attempt to keep up with them. There's a couple hecklers here, and they actually seem to appreciate it when you heckle them back.
Hey, pitcher, pull the ball. Hey, pitcher, you better put some heat on that if you want to sign.
Some of it was very clever. He's been doing this. We were told he's been doing this for every team that visits. So he's very experienced. He gets to try out his material on different teams.
Hey, you better make it. You better make it look good, because I overheard that.
And he was a partisan for the San Quentin team, definitely. So he was riding all of our players in a very, very loud and I found pretty funny ways. You know, he was a good heckler.
He's thinking. He's going backwards right now, man. He's going out backwards. Hey, don't make it that easy for me, buddy.
He says, all right, I got to leave you alone for a while. I got to go to the chiropractor. And he just kept going and going. I looked at him. I said, I thought you were going to the chiropractor. He goes, I'm just having too much fun. Finally, he left. But it was actually almost too quiet when he left.
Hey, no, that's not how you do it. Oh, boy. Hey, way
to go. These guys are really nice guys. And everybody understands that they.
Sorry, I hate to interrupt. We're going to have Nicole bat. First time a woman has ever batted here.
So Nicole came down. She's the girlfriend of one of the Seattle players, and she came down. And talking to her experience, she had a great experience. I was actually kind of concerned. You know, what is it like to put a woman suddenly in the midst of thousands of prisoners who probably haven't been around a woman in a long time, male prisoners? But she said she was treated with great respect. She didn't feel like anybody was harassing her in any way. She felt very comfortable right away.
I mean, you think you're coming into a maximum security prison, right? So you're going around a bunch of criminals, right? Are they going to be intimidating? Are they going to be rude? Are they going to try to scare you? And they haven't at all. You can tell that they want us here.
So you had a very special time today. So tell us what happened.
Yeah, so I was asked to do the honorary first at-bat for our team, and come to find out, I'm the first female to actually have an at-bat here at the prison. And even though I got out, I almost made it to first base, and then I did actually break the bat, so first person to break the bat in the series as well. So I get a souvenir out of the deal.
People outside coming into prison think that we're all bad and we're all evil. And I try to convey to them that, look, we made mistakes. You know, we got caught, and right now we're serving our time for it. You know, and so to me personally, I hope that they take the message out there that we're, you know, we're human beings also.
You know, I know the people who get to San Quentin, they're serious criminals. They've done things. They've been convicted of serious crimes. And I was just really astounded at how friendly, compassionate, interested people were. You know, I'm not letting anybody off the hook for crimes they committed, because I know there are victims behind all these crimes, you know, very serious crimes. But I was just astounded at how appreciative they were, how respectful they were of me and the team for coming down to be with them. And when I came out, I kind of felt it was like one of the most important days of my life. Sorry. It's hard to explain. You know, it was just baseball, but I think just being around so many people who had made terrible mistakes, and, you know, some of them, if they were out today, they may make the same mistakes, but it really talked to me about the potential all these people had and maybe still have, and what a waste it has been. Sorry. I just met people who had things gone better in their lives, would have different lives now. I talked to people who I really thought had kind of leadership potential and could have been out doing really productive things, but for bad choices or bad situations they got themselves into. And so I was really saddened by the loss of that potential for those lives. And I think that's what's really going to stick with me.
Steve Albertson is Director of Administration here at CanKX. Steve did much of the recording for that story, and we also had some help from another person. Erlon Woods was an inmate at San Quentin and also the host of the award-winning podcast Ear Hustle about life on the inside. He did several of the interviews for us, and just days before our first airing of this story, Erlon's sentence was commuted. He's now a free man. This is Sound Effect. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and as we rally support for your independent station, KNKX, we're listening back to stories about connections. Rosette Royale was not expecting a connection, let alone a life-changing relationship, when he got a routine-sounding assignment for Real Change. That's a Seattle-based newspaper sold on the street by vendors who are homeless. Rosette is a longtime reporter and writer. But this assignment turned out differently from Rosette's other work at the paper.
I was working at Real Change newspaper as assistant editor, and I had a coworker who said, "Hey, have you heard about this vendor here? His name is Bryant Carlin. He goes out to the Olympic National Park with his camera and stays for a couple weeks at a time and takes these pictures. They're really pretty good." So I thought, oh, great, I'll just interview him. Then that's easy to do, and then we have photos from his trips, and bam, bam, like that's a quick story, it's done, sold. So I set up a time to meet Bryant.
First, I just like to ask people their name.
Bryant Carlin.
Bryant slept on top of a picnic table in Woodland Park. When it was warmer, he slept in the horseshoe pits. You know, there's an area where there are horseshoe pits there.
You described yourself as a visual immersion photographer? Wilderness,
you know, he's got this immersion. Urban existence, homelessness, alcoholism. He is a drinker of malt liquors. One of those cans is about 3 cans of beer. So Bryant can drink 2, 3, 4, 5 of them a day, every day. And then he's got this outdoor existence where he's this fantastic outdoorsman, wild man, weeks alone with a camera.
I usually take no less than 2 weeks in a single location.
His photos tell these amazing, beautiful stories of this world that is so close to us. And so I was really, really impressed with his ability to take pictures.
And I pretty much just relax into the wilderness and let it unfold in front of me.
I asked him, of course, how did you wind up doing this? What led you to go to the Olympics? And he kind of got quiet for a few seconds. And then he told me how he was living in Alabama.
93, it was my 23rd, 22nd, doesn't matter. It was one of my birthdays. I went down to Florida. I got in trouble for DUI. And I was sitting in jail in Florida, and the library in the jail in Florida had an Alaska magazine. And I was like, man, I gotta do something else with my life. And I just decided I was gonna go to Alaska and be a photographer.
And then 6 months later, He moved from Alabama to the Northwest. And he had a coworker, and the coworker said, "Why are you going to go to Alaska? You can just go to Olympic National Park. It's just a couple hours away." And Brian went to the park and fell in love. And so ran the interview in the paper, and then I just kind of got caught up in work. And I would run into Brian every, I don't know, 2 or 3 months. And he would say, "Hey, you want to go out to the Olympics with me? You know, I'm going out in a couple weeks. The elk will be bugling. Or, you know, the wildflowers are just going to be blooming." Every time he asked me, I had a great excuse. "Oh, I'm too busy with work. Oh, I'm going out of town that weekend." And so they were all kind of little lies, because I didn't really want to go. I was just terrified. I don't know how to camp. I'm not a camper. I don't want to backpack for 10 days. And that's what Brian does. And so it was intimidating to me. And then one time he said to me again, "Hey, I'm going out to the woods. Do you want to come with me? I think it'll be great. We can stay out there, you know, maybe for like a week." And I was about to say no. And we were in the office downtown in Pioneer Square. And I looked out the window and, you know, it was this urban street, construction vehicles. Some guy ran in an alleyway and was taking a hit off of a pipe. And I thought, here is this man who has been inviting me out to a place that is so different from the world that I see every day. And why do I keep saying no? And what would happen to me if I said yes? So I said, sure. And, you know, that yes totally changed my life. Well, I borrowed a friend's tent and packed up and picked up Bryant in Woodland Park. And, you know, we drove out and started hiking in.
The elk trails to me are the key to finding some of the most unique and pristine areas in this park.
Bryant walks so fast on the trail. And so that sometimes meant that he would turn a corner and I wouldn't see him. And the backpack I had on, I didn't know how to put it on, so it kept hitting me in the back of the head, so I couldn't really look forward. I could only look at my feet. So it was horrible. I was miserable. I was so miserable. I'm black, and my whole life, my family has always told me, like, "Black people don't go camping. You're gonna get killed out there, boy. That is crazy. Don't go do that." But I realized that I had absorbed this whole fear of the wilderness that my whole family and all the black people I knew all had. In the city, I know what bus to take. I can figure out how to get somewhere. But out in the wilderness, like, I don't know how to read the land. I was clueless, totally clueless. I was in Bryant's territory. We would be walking through the woods and he would just turn off the trail and he'd go start walking. I'm like, "Where are you going?" He's like, "I'm following the elk trail." And I'm like, "What elk trail?" He's like, "We're standing on the elk trail, look." And then I would look down and I realized that we were standing in this little trail, which I hadn't noticed. And he could be so calm. You know, we'd have these moments where we would sit by the river and he would just sit there and I would look at him and he would seem so at peace.
I love humanity, but I also love the variety and beauty of the life of this world, the song of the wren, the bugles of the elk.
And then Bryant decided that he was going to go on a little solo journey himself, and so he left me alone. And I was just terrified, so terrified that something bad was going to happen to me, and I couldn't look at anything. And so I was sitting there next to this tree, and I heard this sound, this zzz, but it was really loud. And I look, and there is this hummingbird that is just fluttering in the air, like looking right at me. You know, it must have hung out for like 30, 45 seconds. And then the hummingbird left, and I thought, what am I doing? I am terrified of a hummingbird. And so I kind of just thought, you know what? You got to let it go. You're out here in this place. It's beautiful. Try to see what's out here and stop living in your head and live in the moment. You know, who knows why things happen? Who knows why people come together, right? But I realized that in some way, Bryant was the agent that helped me become more comfortable in the wilderness, the place that terrified me, that I didn't understand. And so when we got back from our trip, we found out shortly after that there was a fire in Olympic National Park. And so this motivated Bryant even more. He was going to go to the park and document it, and he was going to be in the woods for 6 months. I thought that was a little much, but Bryant was really gung-ho about it. He said he knew what to do. He had his camera. He was going to document it, and he was going to make this record of a drought and a rainforest, which, of course, seemed ironic to him. So here it is. It's June 2015. It's July 2015. Bryant says, I'm going to go out. Still hasn't gone out. Then it's September 2015. Fire is still smoldering. Bryant hasn't made it. Why hasn't Bryant made it? He's been on a drinking binge, so he hasn't been able to get out there. So finally, in mid-September 2015, I'm like, Bryant, listen, if you really want to go out there, I will go out there. Let's go. We finally go out there, but we couldn't go farther up the trail because the trail was closed because of the fire. This frustrated Bryant.
Turn around, it's something else.
And also, Bryant had gone cold turkey and he was having the DTs. So he was shaking, he was sweating, he was a mess. He was a total mess.
I want to get off with the alcohol for good.
I thought, is this what I'm going to have to go through for the next 6-7 days? Is to listen to someone yell and cry and scream every 15 minutes?
You get a ticket to eternity in hell!
And the last day we were there, we were walking up the trail, and walking down the trail comes the chief fire management officer of Olympic National Park, who had opened up the trail. So Bryant's like, we're going to go. So we like stormed 7 miles up trail, and we get to this place where we could see where the fire was, and it was so completely anticlimactic. I mean, it was just sort of this brown spot in the green wilderness, and there was a little wisp of smoke. So it was just this trip that for Bryant was really frustrating. For me, it was liberating. It was so beautiful. I'd never heard bugling elk before. It was a stunning, unearthly sound. We had this one encounter where this giant bull elk walked across the trail as we were walking back to our camp. And I mean, the animal was massive. I'd never seen an animal that big, that close. So it was incredible. And I was just pointing out to Bryant all these beautiful moments we had had on this trip. But to him, it was just frustration. Because to him, it was the opportunity to change his life. He thought, if I can document this, people will listen to me and pay attention to me. And then I'll be taken for real and I'll be serious. And I'm going to be a different person. And my life's going to change. But that's not how it went. You know, Bryant had to go back to the streets. So there it is. It's October 2015, November, December. Bryant can't let go of this idea of 6 months. He really wants to do it. Finally, he's like, you know, I'm going to start in January of 2016. And I'm like, January, Bryant, it's freezing. He said, oh, it's not that bad. I mean, I sleep outside in the city. It's not that much colder in the park out there. So this time we decided to go to the Ho Rainforest. We left the first week of January 2016. And, you know, I'd spent those several days, and then Bryant was going to start his journey, his 6 months. And so I got in the van and drove away and left him there. And we had planned to meet up in 6 weeks. So we met up, and then I'm planning to go back to the city, and he goes, you know what? I think I'm going to leave, and I'm going to go back to the city with you. And I'm like, really? What about your 6 months? He said, well, I got to get a permit, and, you know, I can just come back in a week or two once I get the permit. So we came back to the city, and Then I found out why we came back to the city.
So did you have something to drink when you went to Forks one time?
Yeah, I did.
Brian admitted that he had hitchhiked out and gotten some beers.
How many? Just one?
Three.
And had gotten drunk.
Well,
and he was embarrassed to tell me. And then he didn't go back. And I was like, Brian, what's going on? He said, well, you know, when I was out there that time and I'd been drinking, I actually had an altercation. I said, what do you mean, an altercation? He said, well, I had an altercation with the ranger. She was asking me some questions, and she took me in her office, and I got loud and got belligerent, and then she handcuffed me, and then she drove me to the police station in Forks, and they kept me overnight. I was like, Bryant? And now he had to go to court. So I drove him to court, and I don't know how it happened, but he had the nicest magistrate in the world.
So it's Wednesday, May 4th. Brian, you just had your little Raymond. How do you think it all went?
Actually, I feel it went far better than how I thought it would go when I first got in trouble.
He was so nice to Brian. The judge talked to him for a little bit and said, you know what, I realize that you do better off in the woods than you do in the city, so let's get you out of court and let's get you back into the woods. Fine, Bryant, $235. That was it. It was such a blessing. I couldn't believe that he'd gotten off that easy. You know, there I was. It was the summer of 2016, and Bryant still hadn't gone back out into the woods to do his 6 months. And then I saw that his dream was slipping away. And I thought, well, what am I going to do? I can't save it for him. But maybe I can try to help him one more time. And I'm like, Brian, listen, if you want to go, like, you know what? Come on, let's go. Like, I'll totally take you. And so we went out again in August 2016. And he was like, okay, I'm going to stay out here. And I'm going to be out here. And I'm going to really do it. And then 5 weeks later, I got a phone call. And it was Brian saying that he was coming back to the city. And that was pretty much the last time he went back to the woods. So that was heartbreaking. I just saw how important the woods were to him. What joy and beauty had done for his life. And it was sad to know that this man who had shown me that joy and that beauty couldn't find his way back out there to experience it again himself. And I still hope that he can reach it one day. But I know as the days go on and as he gets older, that it becomes harder and harder and harder. But also the thing that happened was that I realized that I could do something that I didn't think that I could do. And so I decided, you know what? I'm gonna go on a solo journey. And so I took a solo trip and I went out by myself and went 7-8 miles up the trail and put my tent out. And then the next 2 days, I didn't see a person. And I realized I never had a time where I hadn't seen someone for 2 days.
It is, what is it, like the 14th of September? And I did it. Time just seemed like it was turned to syrup. It just took for, not forever, it was just slow. And it was so
it was
nice, it didn't rain.
Like three of the best days of my life. And I had the four tweets. So, this man who had taken these solo journeys, who kept inviting me to go, led me to go on my own solo journey. And my whole life changed. One time when we were out in the woods, he said to me, you know what? I want my story to have a happy ending. And I said, Bryant, you know what? I do too. I said, but you know, maybe your story will be bittersweet. And maybe there's a lot for everyone else in the story of someone who has a bittersweet tale.
Rosette Royale is a journalist in Seattle. You can see some of Bryant's photographs on our website. Go to knksoundeffect.org. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, this is Sound Effect, and we're asking for your support today as we tell stories about connection. Sometimes there's no lonelier place than a crowded bus. I think a lot of us have had that feeling of being isolated even though you're surrounded by people. And it seems to be heightened in a place like Seattle, where the so-called Seattle freeze means people tend to keep their distance. Well, Susan Fee had heard that about Seattle plenty of times, but she always knew she still wanted to move back here. She and her husband both grew up in Federal Way, and career stuff had pulled them into various parts of the Midwest. Once they became empty nesters, it seemed like time to return to Seattle. And those grumblings that the city had grown frosty in the 25 years since she'd left were not going to stop her.
So I had already been doing some research and knew of the Seattle freeze. I didn't buy it, though. I thought, I've got the kind of personality, I have the skills, I'm going to crack this code. So we just decided to flip life upside down, and we sold our suburban house, we sold everything. And the other different thing for me was I decided I didn't want to have a car. I want to be a pedestrian, and I wanted to take on the challenge of getting around Seattle and where I had to go by either bus or walking. And I arrived back ready to go, making friends, getting into the community, emailing people, saying hi. And I put a lot of energy into that with little return. The bus culture is interesting. I love it. There's that moment when you do get a window seat or an aisle seat and you sit down and you see people get on the bus and they do that scan, that quick scan of where they're going to sit. And many times there's a seat next to me that's open and they don't take it. Why? I seem friendly. Why don't you want to sit next to me? But many times I'll get on and say hi to the driver and they look shocked. They're just like, why are you engaging? I've never been acknowledged when I sit down. Not even a look. I think that's odd. So I don't know. It's enough to keep my mind thinking about it all the time.
Tell us a little bit more about the 545, like as a baseline. What is the normal feel aboard that bus?
It's the library bus. It is the quietest bus you'll ever be on. Everyone gets on with their earbuds in already, their headsets, and they are occupied. So I had really been trying to make friends, not just trying to get used to my new job and the city, but just trying to reach out and make conversation. And I was starting to feel a little discouraged, And one day I'm waiting for my bus, and first thing I see are all these stuffed animals on the dashboard. They look exactly like a bunch of Care Bears, like 20 of them out there. So the bus opens and the door opens, and before I can be the first one to say hello, which I always am, this bus driver says, well, hello, hello, welcome, come on in. And right away I notice that she has written over the first four windows. She's written her name. There's like neon pink and green and blue and smiley faces, messages all over the front windows. And that's how I learn her name is Bonnie. I call her Care Bear Bonnie. And I think, wow, Bonnie, like, I want to be your new best friend. And so we keep going along and picking up people. And this is the library bus. And so people don't normally engage. And she is engaging. And you can just see people looking around like, what is that noise? What is this thing called talking? And then we get over off of 520. We're coming into downtown. And she takes the mic again. And she starts giving us a little tour. All right, our next stop, downtown Seattle. If you look on the far right, South Lake Union. Isn't that beautiful? Like she was doing a tour guide. And you know what? I actually looked. I'd seen that view 1,000 times, but I looked because I thought, she sees something I don't. It just was so apparent to me that I used to be more like that, and I'm not. And she really, in a 40-minute trip, inspired me to just be bold again. Who cares if it just seems way too friendly? And I thought, tomorrow when I take the bus home, and it's going to be a little bit like my Cheers, right? Everybody knows my name, at least Bonnie will know my name, and I'll have someone to talk to on the way home. But she didn't show up, and she didn't show up, and she didn't show up. I never got her as a bus driver again.
For Susan, Care Bear Bonnie was this magical being who appeared out of nowhere and then, poof, gone, like a ghost. Still, she was so inspired by the encounter that she told a version of this tale at a live storytelling event called Fresh Ground Stories. The story got picked up by the newsletter The Evergrey. People started recognizing Susan at other events and would ask her if she ever found Care Bear Bonnie. Susan, it seems, had tapped into something. If she had been your driver again, what would you have wanted to say to her?
I first of all would have thanked her for continuing to reach out and talk to people even when it was clear for some they were tired of that. And it didn't stop her. She was brave, and that inspired me to just get up again. I'm going to say hello. I'm going to say goodbye. And I'm not going to give up. I am going to break that freeze and reach out and create a circle of friends. And I will say, through telling the story of Bonnie, that has happened more, for sure.
Could you describe what Bonnie looks like to the best of your memory?
Bonnie is a presence. So she's about 30 years old. She has brown hair, right? No! Are you kidding?
Hi.
Oh my gosh! Oh my gosh!
Nice to meet you in person.
Oh my gosh, I'm gonna cry.
That's the point. Surprise!
You guys are so great.
Surprise.
Oh, I wish I had my Care Bear to give to you.
Well, Susan, meet Bonnie. Bonnie,
oh,
meet
yes,
Susan.
In person. We've never been on the same bus again. Yeah, so first of all, I wanted to thank you because I didn't realize until I met you or watched you how much I had kind of given up. You know, that I just kind of let Seattle kind of get to me. And then you just, you know, appeared like this magic bus. And you actually interact. You're everything I wanted to be. And I really wanted to tell you that the next day because I thought you were going to be my permanent bus driver.
Everybody's life would be so much better if everyone was like me.
Right.
No, I'm totally joking.
But I was going to keep up a conversation. Like, I was really looking forward to taking the bus home every day because I thought we'd chat.
We probably would have.
See?
Every day.
Maybe, you know, get a cup of coffee or a happy hour. Like, I really had this whole plan. I was so excited. And then you weren't there and you weren't there and you weren't there. So
now she's making me cry.
But you stayed with me. Even though I didn't meet you, I had you. And because of you, I ended up meeting more people. So it's a little infectious. So I wanted to say thank you.
You're very, very welcome. But I'm going to tell you a secret.
Okay.
So I actually had somebody get on my bus the other day and go, wait, your name's Bonnie? Do you have a nickname? And I went, Care Bear Bonnie? And he's like, oh my gosh, I met Care Bear Bonnie in person. And I was like, I didn't know this was a thing. And I went, have a great day.
One of the things that we were talking about was that taking a chance to smile at somebody or offer a friendly comment or whatever, even though you don't know how they're going to react or whatever, it's a little bit of a leap of faith that you are going to sort of make that person feel better. And I just wonder what it's like to have proof now that the good that you put out into the world really does make a difference.
It makes my heart full of joy that I can actually do that for other people. I mean, I've told I don't know how many different people that bringing a smile and a laugh to at least one person a day is what I consider my job, but I never realized that it was that infectious. You know, you can crack jokes and be a goofball and put stuffed animals in your windshield and write little happy hump day all over your bus or just be an in general nut and then actually have somebody come back up to you and go, wow, hey, thank you. It means the world. Like, I may be having a really bad day, but hey, the show must go on.
What do you think, like, what would your advice be for the average, you know, Seattleite or Seattle area resident, whether they ride the bus or not, how to thaw the freeze a little bit?
Open your eyes, look around, you live in a gorgeous, exponentially beautiful place. If you want to meet somebody, walk outside, people. Stop being so shy. Smile. It doesn't hurt. Your face isn't going to crack. I'm not afraid to wave at people on the freeway and go, hi, all five fingers.
Bonnie Robinson is a driver for Metro, still driving the 545, among others. Susan Fee is a mental health counselor and a storyteller in Seattle. That story was produced by Bethany Denton. Sound Effect is produced by Kevin Kniestad, Jennifer Wing, and Posey Gruner. We had help this week from Paul Currington, Rosette Royale, Erlon Woods, William Drummond, and Kari Plogue. Our executive producer is Matt Martinez. Now, I want to take a second to tell you about a cool thing that we're doing. On October 16th, we'll be hosting a special Sound Effect movie night at the Grand Cinema in Tacoma. We'll be showing a personal favorite of mine, which was filmed right here in the Pacific Northwest, War Games. Matthew Broderick, Ali Sheedy. We'll follow it with a fun little Q&A about nuclear annihilation, and we'll connect. More info at the calendar page at knkx.org. While you're there, consider a gift of support during our fall fun drive, Every Bit Counts. We're back next week when our theme is Squeaky Wheel. I'm Gabriel Spitzer, and this is KNKX.